This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Louis Rubin's influence on the literary world cannot be overstated. He mentored some of the best contemporary Southern writers, names like Lee Smith, Jill McCorkle, and Clyde Edgerton. He helped start Algonquin Books so that Southern writers would have somewhere to go when the big New York publishing houses wanted nothing to do with them. And he, more than anyone else, framed the idea of Southern literature. And in doing so, he gave countless authors the confidence to continue their writing. Louis Rubin died earlier this month. We're remembering him today, and joining us to talk about him are Shannon Ravenel, co-founder of Algonquin Books. Welcome back, Shannon. Good
Thanks,
to have you
Frank.
Here. Also with us, Lee Smith, author of many books, including On Agate Hill and her latest, Guests on Earth. Lee Smith, good to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Clyde Edgerton, author of, again, many works, The Night Trains and The Bible Salesman among them. Clyde Edgerton, good to talk with you.
Happy to be here.
Jill McCorkle is with us as well, talented writer and author of Life After Life and Caroline Moon, among others. Jill, good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Shannon, let me start with you. When you think of Lewis and his influence on writers and literature, what do you think? How would you explain his legacy?
Oh, it's too big to explain. I think Lewis had an amazing capacity for helping people. He loved literature, and he loved anybody who also loved literature. So whether you were his student, or he was your editor or your publisher, or he was writing a book for your publishing house, Lewis was always so empathetic with the other person that I think none of us can really understand how he managed to be that way with so many people.
Lee Smith, tell us how you met him.
Well, I was about 18 years old, and I was a freshman at Hollins College in Roanoke, Virginia, now Hollins University. And he was one of my first creative writing teachers, and we became, from then on, fast friends, and he was my mentor. And I frankly don't think I would ever have become a writer had it not been for Lewis.
What were your aspirations at the time? Were you going to be a writer, devote your life
to
writing?
Well, I was, yes. I mean, even at that age, I wanted to be a writer. All I did was read and write terrible drivel, which was, I thought I had to wear a black turtleneck and live in France and, you know, have big experiences. And Lewis kept saying, well, you got to write what you know. You got to trust what you know. But I didn't know what I knew. Until he had us write, I mean, he had us read the fiction of people like Eudora Welty and brought Eudora Welty to campus. And there was a person, you know, a writer of the highest literary quality who hadn't been anywhere much either.
Yeah, but that can be daunting, right? But
that's
scarier than heck. This is Eudora Welty. She's famous. I'm not. How does he translate that into you can do this too?
Because she wrote about simple people from small, isolated places, and suddenly all the people and things of my own life seemed like a fit subject for literature, for writing. That it meant everything.
Clyde Edgerton, you met him, I guess, when he had helped start Algonquin. Tell us about your first meeting.
I didn't know he had I just knew his name from Sylvia Wilkinson and my then wife Susan Ketchin, who had taken a course with him, and I started reading his work, and he was a literary hero just because of his writing. It was so clear and simple, but it was also about the South in a way that made me know that there was a connection, a whole literary world I did not understand. So I sent him a chapter of a book I was working on, and it eventually it was published, and I had to deliver it to his garage where Algonquin Books was. And at the time, not knowing what I didn't know what I was doing, I handed him the manuscript, and I'd written him a note saying I wanted the color to be of the cover to be green, and I wanted to have some say-so about the font. And he looked at me sort of funny, and he leaned forward, and he said, "Friend?" And I knew that somehow I'd said something wrong. And he said, "They don't tell you how to write it. You don't tell them how to design it." And then we started talking about the characters in the book. This is so characteristic of my experience with Lewis. He would come on hard and clear, and then he would we go into a different world. And so we started talking about the names of my characters, and we couldn't think of one of the aunts. And I was driving away from his house, and I heard him holler, and I stopped and looked back. He was on the lawn. He was yelling to me, Naomi. And I said, what? He said, Naomi, N-A-O-M-I. That's the name. And I drove away, and I had a great name for me, because that's my first meeting with Lewis.
Well, Jill, how about you? You met him at UNC for the first time, right?
I did. And in fact, I had just had Lee's intermediate level class, and up ahead was the advanced workshop. And I knew who Lewis was long before I actually met him, because he always kept his office door open there in Greenlaw Hall, and you would just hear his typewriter just going just miles a minute, and you'd see smoke, either cigar or pipe smoke, just wafting out of the office. And I was terrified of him. I had passed him in the hall quite a few times. And so I met him for the first time when I went to his house, where we met for our class.
What did you have? Again, were you aspiring to be a writer? This was it for you. And how did he influence you?
Oh, I can say ditto to what Lee said. I knew I wanted to write, but I could not imagine that I was going to go out in the world and be able to do anything with it. Mm. And I was about to graduate, and I went to see him, and which I had started doing pretty regularly, maybe not to nuisance state, but getting close probably. And I would wait outside his office, and I told him, you know, well, I just wasn't sure what I was going to do. And he said, well, I think you're going to go to graduate school, and I think you should apply here. And he just laid it all out. And, you know, I was like, really? Really?
Well, Shannon, did you have a kind of similar experience in the way he sort of saw what you, your...
Yes, I met him as a student as well. And this was when it was his first year at Hollins, my second. And I met him in the registration hall, the day we had to choose our courses. And he recognized my name. Ravenel is a Charleston name. He was from Charleston. And he said, oh, we're from the same town. And that was it. We were friends forever. He was my, I majored in English, and he was my professor and my mentor and my advisor. And come junior year, he had figured out that I wasn't going to be a writer, but that I might be an editor, because I liked so much to take apart other people's stuff. In the writing workshops, I really enjoyed it. Sorry to say.
It's a lot easier, isn't it, in some ways?
So much easier, much
book.
Easier.
Yeah.
Anyway, he said, you know, you should probably go into publishing. And I said, yeah, I've just seen this movie called The Best of Everything, and the girl in it gets a job in publishing, and about a week later she discovers this fabulous writer. They publish him. She marries him. It sounds good. I think that's a good idea, Lewis. And he said, well, you know what? The next thing you need to do is you need to run to be the editor of the magazine, the literary magazine at Hollins. And I said, well, I can't do that because I want to be president of House Board, if you can believe it.
And what would that be?
Not much.
Okay.
Right? But it was, I was sort of a student, you know, council wonk. And he said, oh, you're so stupid. He said, do not run for House Board. Run for the literary magazine. And I said, no, I'm deaf. So anyway, on and on. So he arranged, there was a point system. You couldn't have more than a certain number of points. If you had one job on campus, you couldn't take another one that, you know, added up to too many points. So he changed it so that I could be the editor of the magazine as well as president of House Board.
But talk about, there's a certain genius here. And Clyde, I know you have a story too. Maybe I'll go back to you and then come back to Shannon for a second. How direct he could be. I saw a great quote in the paper where sort of those letters that you would get in response to your manuscript. Maybe I'll let you give the quote and talk about how very direct and blunt he was about your writing, right? Everybody's writing.
Mm-hmm.
Clyde?
Well, in my case, he took on somebody who couldn't write very well. And so, but he took the novel and he saw the first novel and saw promise in it and asked Shannon to look at it. And then he wrote a 2 or 3 page single spaced letter, which told me that basically it said you're kind of looking down your nose at the South in some ways. Mm. You shouldn't be doing that. What's the why? And I immediately saw how to rearrange the book. But he read every book of mine that I've ever published several times, sometimes once, but sometimes many times. He would read any time, and he would, and within a week, he would have the book back. And it would be not marked up much, but there would be a letter. And several of my letters started out, "Well, old buddy, comma, it's not working, period." Then, in the letter, I mean, I would be demolished, but before I'd finish the letter, he would give me confidence. Mm. He would say, "Nobody else can do this. You can do it. Here's what to think about." And there was, the letters were very inspirational, but also very blunt. And it was such a healthy relationship in that way. I knew I could count on him to tell me when I should be in the character's head instead of my character's head. I remember many times I'd have a preacher, and he'd say, "This preacher is not thinking for himself. He's thinking for you. Get your stuff, get your Wittgenstein and all that baloney out of his head and let him be a country preacher, and he can do as much as..." And so he was great. And asked me what it was about. What's the novel about? Finally, I learned I'd start to go see him, and I'd go back home and figure out what it was about. Then I'd go see him because I knew he would ask that right away. And it's so important.
On the State of Things Today, the life and legacy of Lewis Rubin, who died earlier this month at the age of 89. We're talking with Clyde Edgerton, Lee Smith, Shannon Ravenel, and Jill McCorkle. And our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and today we're talking about the life and legacy of Lewis Rubin with Shannon Ravenel, co-founder of Algonquin Books, Lee Smith, her latest novel is Guests on Earth, Clyde Edgerton, an author of many works, including The Night Trains, and Jill McCorkle, another talented writer, Life After Life and Caroline Moon, all part of the work, much of the work that is they will attribute to the ability of their mentor, Lewis Rubin. And Lee Smith, apparently he stayed with you. You started talked about being with him at Hollis College, which is where he started teaching. Them, right. And stayed in touch that whole time.
Stayed in touch the whole time. And when I started publishing, I actually started with Harper & Row before he founded Algonquin. This was before he founded Algonquin. And then I was with Putnam for years. But I was always running my manuscripts past Lewis. Because invariably he wouldn't say much, but what he said was the one thing that you had to listen to. And I think it's what Clyde was sort of alluding to. What is this about? You know, what is the theme? Because when you're deep in the individual scenes and characters, you can't see the whole. And he would just simply, he wasn't even directive. He would just ask a question or two.
That question, that
it was wonderful.
That business that Clyde's talking about, this sort of saying, get your words out of their mouth, and how do you do that? And what's the influence of a guy, of a teacher and a mentor? Because you're all teaching now too, and how do you do that? Bring somebody to the point where they can tell the difference between their voice and the voice of their characters. I'll stick with you, Lee, and then we'll go around the table.
Well, I think once it's pointed out to you, you understand it. You know, and you can never have characters mouthing your theme or mouthing just information from the past that you know, Frank, when I inherited this farm in 1931 or something like that. I mean, there's all kind of things that once someone points it out to you, you get it. But until they point it out, you don't.
Jill?
Yeah, absolutely. Lewis was very good at asking those questions just right down to word choice, maybe showing where you missed an opportunity or even sending you to a very specific paragraph in a Welty story, I remember specifically, just so you see what's happening on the page. There was always an example.
And there has to be something about the way he did it, Shannon, because if you come to him as an aspiring writer in college and he says to you, you know, as a writer, you'd make a great editor, I mean, that's got to hurt one way or another.
No,
or did it not?
It didn't really, because I didn't think I was a great writer either, even though I did manage to publish my own poem in the magazine that he said I should edit.
Well, there may have been some connection.
I should not have done that. But, no, it was not hurtful at all. And, you know, I was thrilled that he thought that I could be an editor. And in those days, it was really hard to make your way up the ladder to do that. And he was always very encouraging. And, you know, if I'd write to him and say, there's this job that I think I could probably get if I did the right moves, he would say, do the right moves. And then he would tell me what the right moves were. The interesting thing is that he was writing letters like that to so many of us.
Yes.
It's hard to believe that he had time. But I think he worked all the time, don't you? I mean, I think the pipe smoke and the typewriter going and everything was his life. He was in touch with many, many, many people and encouraging them.
He worked and he sang and he fished and he Clyde, I mean, you knew him.
Did he sing?
Well, he played music and I was interested in music. And you knew him it's kind of for your fishing outings. Is that right, Clyde?
Oh, well, we went fishing many times. And he had a little narrow boat and he couldn't swim and he had these wings that he could pull and they would inflate under his arms, and he'd occasionally trip and miss one. One would go off, and he'd had almost turned the boat over, and it was just an amazing trip. We went many times over four summers, I think, back in the 90s. We never caught a fish, never. But I've been with him when we did catch fish at other times, but on those particular trips in the little boat, and I've been with him with broken down boats and just amazing adventures. There was always an adventure when you went somewhere with Lewis.
You know, we were talking about him as a mentor and a teacher, but he was a writer. He wrote, and maybe we can get some samples of his writing now, and you can tell us a little bit about Lewis Rubin as a writer. Lee Smith?
Well, it's amazing to me. I mean, anybody that can write like he could write, he published 3 novels, numerous poems, and he was an absolutely incredible writer. For instance, he wrote one story that I will never forget, so beautiful, named the St. Anthony Chorale, which was published in the Southern Review and then picked by John Updike as one of the best stories of the century.
Me first.
Ah!
I gave it
Shannon.
To John, yes.
Yeah, for her best stories of the South.
No, I think it was Best American Short Stories.
Oh, okay.
That's what it was.
But it was wonderful. But let me just read a paragraph. How about that? Yeah. This is from a lovely novel named The Golden Weather, which is a kind of a coming of age. It's a sort of the artist as a passionate young man. And I have to say, this prose, you know, really equals James Joyce or Thomas Wolfe, the people he admired so much. In it, the narrator has taken for the first time a trip in an airplane and is looking down on his beloved hometown, Charleston. I thought at that moment that I could spend a lifetime and not exhaust what I saw. I promised myself that I would know city and country and bay, shade and shadow, every arranged point of light, each secret part, until it would all become so completely my own that we should be one another, my mind forever suffused in summer and amber air, sea and sun, sand and city, all woven together in one fabric, a carpet of reds, blues, greens of 1,000 hues, the matchless color of light, a universe of gradations, unroll before me in every direction, bathed every bit of it in translucent brightness, all of a golden weather, held forever in my all-seeing eyes. And, of course, that's the golden weather of youth, and nobody's ever captured it better. He could really write, not only, you know, teach writing and be an incredible critic, but he could just write like crazy himself.
What's his place among the writers? His name, it seems to me, is not among the names of the greats, and yet his writing is, it belongs there, doesn't it?
I think it does belong there. I think that Lewis's literary professionalism and his books about writing have a great place in the literary echelons. I think his fiction is wonderful, but it never, if there were only 3 novels out of 50 plus books, And I think he, you know, people were much more interested in his criticism and his understanding of Southern, whether Southern literature took, you know, how it took its place in American literature. So I think his fiction suffered just by dint of his reputation as a scholar and not a writer. Don't you think?
I do. I just think he was so protean. He could have done anything. Yeah. And nobody else happened to be inventing Southern literature at the time.
At the same time, right.
Talk more about that. What is his role in inventing Southern literature? I mean, what do you mean about that? By that? Does he invent Southern literature? I read somewhere where, you know, Faulkner never knew he was a Southern writer until Lewis Rubin came along and then created this way of understanding a regional writing.
He was very early in his career, as I think he was still in graduate school, he wrote a book called The Southern Renaissance, spelling of Renaissance, very different from what I would have thought. And that book apparently took hold of people's attention because he put it so well. He put together his arguments, and I think that was the beginning of his interest in it. And then he kept writing more and more about it. He established all kinds of things in honor of Southern literature, a Fellowship of Southern Writers. He established when? 25? Was it 25 years ago? Mm-hmm. And he also did something with the fugitives, wrote books about them, the agrarians. He saw what the connections were and how they made that bulk of literature important in the overall canon.
Clyde Edgerton, how important was that, the idea of framing an idea of Southern literature in sort of giving permission for you all here at the table to talk about the things that were, you know, if it's right what you know, people may not have been interested, or you thought, in what Southerners knew. How important was it to have that intellectual idea to give you the permission to write the way you write, Clyde?
Well, it was a boost. He could write about Southern writing in a way that was so clear and persuasive, whether religion, place, community, so many aspects which put together, especially if you'd grown up in that and then gone to a university, much of what he talked about, rural community and agrarianism and animals and plants and there was a tension produced, which I think many of us in the South, we write out of a certain tension. And he recognized so much about what we were doing and could say it so clearly. A book called The American South, Portrait of a Culture. When I read the introduction to that, I just couldn't believe how clear it was. And it's in some cases controversial now, but I just send people back to read what he says about what it is, what Southern writing is. It's not looking down on any other kind of writing, or it just shows how it's different. And he was so sophisticated in his clarity. He was one of the most unsophisticated people and the most sophisticated people I ever met in delightful ways that
unsophisticated.
Made him invisible.
What do you mean, unsophisticated how?
Well, he was blunt. His explanations weren't, quote, sophisticated. He was clear and blunt, and also he didn't care about he didn't care a lot about what he looked like, for example, in terms of and he didn't care about. I mean, the story was that, you know, in Algonquin books, you know, he'd had lunch if you saw brownie crumbs in his chair when he was walking around. It means he had had lunch that day. There are many stories, and he was delightful. But people just need to read what he wrote anywhere, a novel or criticism, and he had an idea about what criticism should be too.
Well, and I know you've prepared a reading that in which he talks about the current state of literary criticism. Is that right?
That's correct.
Will you read that for us?
Sure. He says, "I have never taken kindly to the notion that the proper task of the critic is to deal with the act of critical perception itself, and not with the thing being perceived. Certainly, the former." Criticism of theories of criticism is a legitimate critical activity, and one that happens to be particularly popular just now. But it is by no means the only critical mode. Indeed, it is a secondary mission only, performed with the object of strengthening the primary goal. I believe that the ultimate and by far the most important goal of literary criticism is to make the work being read, the story, the poem, more nearly available to readers, and that as such, the critic and the critique are ancillary to the work. I believe it can be made more available, though never entirely so. Anyone who claims greater usefulness for criticism than that and demands a status for the critic co-equal with that of the poet or novelist, whether in the name of, quote, freedom, end quote, or anything else, is, to my mind, afflicted with delusions of professional or perhaps professorial grandeur.
That is, yes, a reading from The Mockingbird and the Gum Tree by Lewis Rubin, read here by Clyde Edgerton. So, yeah, I guess that's it. Is that, to some extent, what he had in mind in creating Algonquin Books? The idea that we want to get books directly to people and share the experience of this place, particularly. What was it about Southern writing? Was it about publishing writers?
He certainly, when he wrote me the first letter about his thoughts about establishing a traditional for-profit publishing house located in the Deep South, his idea was to make it accessible to kids and young writers or old writers or anybody who just didn't have contacts in the Northeast with New York. But he never intended for Algonquin to publish only Southern authors. That was a very, very clear thing from the very beginning. We did, in the early days, publish an awful lot of Southern writers because they knew about us, and we knew about them. But always he would say, now remember, we are not a Southern publishing company. We're just located in the South.
Jill McCorkle.
No, how well that
but well, we know your address and you're kind of close, so why don't we just stop in now and then and see how Shannon's doing. Jill, you brought something to read as well. Tell us about that and sort of how this has an impact on you as a writer as well.
Yeah, I was going to say one of my great surprises when I got to know Lewis was how attached he always was to childhood memory and pieces that other people would have just cast off as teenage angst. He really was all about facing it and embracing it. And, you know, he was a big fan of Proust and always talking about those early memories. And that is what I see in his own fiction, where he allowed himself. And well, I brought two things. I brought Surfaces of a Diamond, which he read in manuscript form to our class when I was a senior. And he said, now you're hearing something that may not be published for a very long time, because sometimes you write things and you're just not ready to let go of it. And we felt so privileged. And just briefly, a paragraph there that I think that goes so well with what we were talking about with his use of memory and his early childhood. He wrote, "Neither in memory nor in the interpretation of its meaning for the present does the truth of our experience lie. It is in the shaping of the lineaments of memory into patterns that will reveal their own meaning that experience becomes real. The way to possess it is to make it into a story that will be authentic, because so much did not happen in that way at all." And for me, with my own work, he was always pushing me back to that place. He loved nothing better than for me to bring in a copy of the Robinsonian when I had been home to Lumberton. And he was always asking about the Lumber River. And in fact, when I was working on my novel July 7th, which was, you know, in the beginning, I was sort of being a little hard on these people in this particular subdivision. And I had named it Le Cour de la Vie. And Lewis is like, oh, no, you can't do that. He said, but the Cape Fear River's mine. How about Cape Fear Trace? So everything came back to rivers and railroads and the ocean. And you know, at a time in my life when I really felt that I needed to reach far and know a lot more than I did, he was forever just pushing me back into a place I was already comfortable in, and sort of saying, it's okay, just stay there. and do what you do.
A great faith, then, in the power of your story and your experience to expose these monumental, mythic ideas that I suppose every writer thinks they're going to kind of expose. But his faith that it's there, the myth and the monumental story, the academic intellectual idea comes through if you're honest about telling a story.
With me, I grew up in the mountains in a real storytelling tradition and couldn't think of myself as a fancy writer. And finally he said, well, just tell a story. Let the character tell the story in her own words. Let her talk, you know. And then, of course, he also handed me The Sound and the Fury. And,
right.
You know,
like
a lot
this.
Of Faulkner was kind of like this. And he said, just go ahead and talk. He said, pretend you're not writing. Just talk. Yeah. And that meant everything.
On The State of Things today, we are talking about the life and the legacy of Lewis Rubin. Lee Smith is with us, Clyde Edgerton, Jill McCorkle, and Shannon Ravenel. And we'll talk more about Lewis Rubin on The State of Things when our program continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about the life and legacy of Lewis Rubin with us, Shannon Ravenel, Lee Smith, Clyde Edgerton, Jill McCorkle. And in the break, Lee Smith, we were talking again, sort of trying to figure out how his writing career compares with his career as a literary critic, his fiction career in fiction compares with criticism and teaching. And you said, well, he just didn't have that kind of ego to pursue fiction.
I think
way.
Most artists of one sort or another have a kind of a monster ego. You just sort of have to keep at it and put it out there, and you don't like to think about that. But Lewis didn't have an ego. He was just wildly passionate about all kinds of things, the last of which was Lewis Rubin, despite his own incredible talent.
How about that, Clyde? I mean, the ego of the writer, the sense that maybe is it that you have this story to tell that everybody must hear, and maybe he didn't feel that way?
I think many of us who write fiction get a thrill out of writing fiction, and we don't get a thrill out of other things as much. And I'm speaking for myself, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I think he got a thrill out of helping people and seeing his work through other people. And he always made jokes. In fact, I'm looking on page 113 of a book here. It says, when I was 38, I published a novel like almost everything else that I have written over the course of what is now at least half a century of consciously trying to write well. It attracted very little attention at the time and none since, period. And he was funny about it. He would say, somebody would be holding a book of his, and he would say, oh, there's that one book that sold. I was on an elevator one time, and he said, oh, there's that book that's sold. And so there was a sense in which he didn't care, but I think he did. But he knew on some level what he was doing and the difference he was making in the world. And I'm astonished that critics and people worldwide don't read him more. His criticism and his blunt knowledge about how memory and time works. Mm. He was obsessed with some big issues and could write about them so well.
Jill, can you give us an idea of how he helped you? And maybe we've been reading and listening to some of his work, but maybe if you read some of yours and tell us how he influenced it and how things might have changed as a result.
Sure. Well, this would be an example of one of those angsty kids he encouraged. So this is from the novel July 7th, the character named Sam Sweat, who is trying to just figure out his place in the world. And I'll read it and then tell you what Lewis said at the end. Sam Sweat shaved his head so he'd look different, so people would be scared. Got rid of everything so people wouldn't want it. Yes, he tossed all of his clothes from the fire escape except these, just these, that he has on, and people came like ants after a piece of bread. 9 minutes is all it took. In 9 minutes, it was all gone, and they couldn't get enough, came back for more, just like everybody, had to have more, couldn't be satisfied, and he was afraid of becoming just like them, thinking like them, not sleeping like them, sick and starving. He is a modern hunger artist, witnessing the death of society, of America, the world. There's a story in all that, but it will not come to him because he can't keep his head held up like a ton of bricks. He rubs his hands around and around his head, feels the stubble, sees the vacancy, vacancy, vacancy neon sign, red and green blinks like a short-circuited Christmas tree. He can see himself between blinks, his hands on his head, looks like someone washing a coconut, vacancy, looking for the monkey face, vacancy, to drain the milk, all of that sweet rich milk, vacancy, split the skull to get that rich white meat, vacancy, eat it up. He can't remember the last time he ate, but that makes him different from these ants crawling around, eating and sleeping, defecating, fornicating, eventually dying. He can be above all that, eat just enough to keep him alive, detach himself from the gluttonous world, remain an individual even though everything else is becoming the same. Then he will be able to tell it in his own words. I saw a dead man. It takes a long time to type that because he has to hold on to his head as well. But he does and then leans forward. And Lewis came back and said, what a missed opportunity that I didn't have the word fornication.
Oh.
And he said, you've said fornication. Fornication rhymes. It's connected to ants. And he said, you just totally miss bringing the sensation onto the page. So fornication is now in there. Right. It's part of the list. But that's the kind of thing he would just try to, he really taught me how to take not just what's being described, but to reach all around it and pull something from a much bigger psychological place, if you can, and plug the two together.
Yeah, but so here's the guy who's saying, you know, don't get too caught up in the big ideas, just tell your story. But then when it's the right moment, he recognizes that you've got a big idea here, and this is the word that's going to pull it all together.
Yeah.
So from top to bottom, the courage to write, and then the little technical detail, what about inserting this word?
And he constantly found that place to just sharpen.
But this does speak to a kind of larger issue. It's one thing to say, look, everybody has a story. Speak in your own voice. Maybe everybody has a story, but not everybody is a writer. Did Lewis Rubin know the difference? Did he work with everybody, or could he tell, do you think, a genius for somebody who is worth his time?
That's such a good question. I brought with me something you don't know about.
Yep.
And that's one of his typical rejection letters.
Oh, all right.
And so if you don't mind,
absolutely.
I would like to just read a little bit about it because this is the way he was. So the first sentence, two sentences, dear Mr. Blank, I'm sorry to report that we won't be able to offer to publish your novel for you. It's been read by several people. Some of it is awfully good, but it's simply too much of a tour de force, a virtuoso experimental performance to make a good book for us. And then he goes on from there for two single-spaced typewritten pages talking about what's good about it and what's bad about it. Mostly, it's pretty strongly negative letter. However, at the end of it, he says, let me therefore propose something. Don't take my word for it. Try this manuscript on some other publishing houses. Maybe I'm all wrong. I've been wrong often enough, God knows. If I am and you do find a publisher, great. But if you're unable to find a publisher, put this manuscript aside and start another. When you've written a couple of chapters, send them to me, and I'll see whether I can offer you a contract.
Wow.
That doesn't...
I mean, he's not going to just write them off. You
no,
know, these
exactly.
things come in over the transom, and it's like enough already.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean,
wow.
Amazing.
Wow. Clyde, what about that, this notion? So then, well, do you think then that he's felt like there was a writer in everybody? Is that...
Well,
Clyde?
I think he wouldn't make that judgment. That letter's a great example of his generosity. He saw something in that writer. I'm sure there are other rejection letters which said many people have read this and we really can't, blah blah blah, but this, he saw something, and he had an eye for storytelling, and he would nourish and say things that, I mean, think about getting that letter and knowing, and just when my first novel was published, I got a letter from Crown Publishing. It said, we would like to publish your second novel. And I took it to him. I said, look, he said, go with them. You'll make more money. Mm-hmm. You might not get the editing you can get here. Well, of course, I didn't go anywhere.
Yeah. So tell us more about Algonquin Books as really, in a sense, his brainchild, its influence, yeah. And the effect that it's had on the publishing world, Shannon.
Well, I don't know if I can say what effect it's had on the publishing world, since so many other things are having so much effect on the publishing world. But I think that what he did prove was that a small company, not in New York, could find and publish well work that was worth noting. And our very first book was a book of short stories by a fairly elderly guy in Louisville called Passing Through, and it was reviewed on the front page of the Washington Post book review section. And the reviewer said, I'll never forget it. The first line was, I've never heard of the author, I've never heard of the publisher, but this is damn good work. And I think
book.
that's what Lewis, you know, did for the industry.
We just got an email from a listener who's listening right now. It says, used to rent a room to the young woman who had just graduated from Hollis. From Hollins. That would be you, I think, Lee. I think she's making reference to you. She brought home a copy of Rainey. I'm not sure about this. I started reading it, stayed home. So we're talking about reading Rainey now. The next day, so I could finish it because I was so taken by the book, I wrote Clyde right after reading it and still have the letter that he wrote back. And I have many Algonquin books and have felt a connection to Algonquin and Mr. Rubin since I moved to Durham 30 years ago. So that's an email
nice.
That we just received. Again, the kind of an intimacy. I mean, I don't – maybe publishers do get letters like that, but I'm guessing there's not that kind of intimate connection with your readers that you can generate.
No, I worked at big publishing houses, and they were very, very different.
Well, I remember opening up the New York Times Book Review – and there was Jill's picture when she was just a girl because she'd written one novel and Lewis had apparently accepted it. In the meantime, she wrote another. So he decided, Algonquin decided, to publish them both simultaneously. And there they were. They came out and there she was on the front page of the New York Times Book Review at age, you know,
whatever.
I don't know what, really young.
I think you were 11 at the time.
And it was,
yeah.
But it was a great send-off for both the author and the press. Mm-hmm. Incredible.
He had ideas like that. He was a great publicist, actually. He really knew how to catch attention, right, Clyde?
Well, he sent, when I was in trouble at Campbell University for my first novel, he sent 50 copies of that novel and 50 letters to 50 universities in the South saying this guy might need a job. And I had 3 job offers out of that. He's got jobs and positions.
50?
And for so many people. I once thought it was 15, and when I told somebody it was 15, he looked at me and said, no, I think it was 50. it was 50.
Remind us why you were in trouble. What do you mean?
Well, I just had some administrators who had problems with the novel for various reasons. It's a long story.
Yeah. What about now? You teach Clyde, and I know, and Lee, and you're all teaching. Jill, you're teaching as well. Let me start with you, Clyde. What effect, or if any, has he had on you as a writing teacher?
I tell my students to follow no advice which doesn't make sense to them, and that's very much in line with what he would say. And I always ask students, what's your book about? That's something else. Those two comments can lead to good things.
Lee?
And it's straight from Lewis.
Well, I think one thing, too, is that Lewis was never never made himself unavailable to his students when the last bell rang. I mean, you would still be presumably writing, and he would still be interested and would, you know, write thousands of people recommendations or give them some sage advice as to what they should do next or all different kinds of things. And I have tried really hard to pass it on because I felt so fortunate to have had that kind of interest.
I mean, that's hard to do, to stay
it's
in touch.
It's real hard
and
to
that's
do.
Something you
it takes
do
a lot of your time.
You feel committed to him in a sense, and you say,
yes.
Well, you know, I might not want to do this, but I owe it to Lewis. How about you, Jill? You're teaching as well?
Yes, and I think the same thing, the generosity or trying to give back what was given, and like Clyde, to ask all of those questions, to take the time to try to understand what it is the student's trying to write as opposed to what I might think the student should be writing. And again, back to tapping into those earliest primal childhood memories, I think it's very easy to not look. And when you tell someone to write what you know, I'm not thinking about the facts of their lives so much as I'm thinking of a sensory palette of the way you might see, hear, remember something. And that's just right out of what Lewis did in class.
It's interesting that he relies so much on and keeps coming back to memory when even in the passage you wrote, he's writing about the unreliability of memory. I mean, there it is, and it's what we have, and yet it's very likely it didn't happen that way.
He was really a thoroughly modern writer and a thoroughly modern consciousness. He was, you know, he was all Jungian. He was all about consciousness and so on. And he would go right to the subconscious. He was a thoroughly, thoroughly modern critic and writer. And he wanted you to get down there. You know, he wanted you to understand what it was
and
that
believe,
you're writing
and
about.
Had absolute faith that it would be accessible, that it wouldn't be so subjective and you know, broken apart that it becomes an experiment in modernism and not very much fun for your readers to read. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think if you keep enough rivers, trains, and baseball on the page.
And dogs.
He had his grounding.
Yeah. He had a lot of dogs. I mean, think about it. He had boats. I mean, you remember the boats he kept? Oh, my gosh. Yes. One was named the Algonquin.
Yeah. Ken, what about?
He also said, this is a I just got this in front of me. Nostalgia is an impoverishing emotion. Hmm. It robs our memory of all its complexity. I hope I have avoided it. And then a few more sentences about memory and time. So,
how do we see that in his work, and how did he convey the difference between nostalgia and this memory that he talked about?
Well, he wasn't big on sentimentality, yeah, which didn't work. On the other hand, he could see it in a character, and he was so blunt and careful and clear about criticism and editing.
We're really running out of time, but Shannon, I want to ask you, the publishing world has changed an awful lot.
Oh, yeah.
Is his influence even relevant today? Still?
Oh, I think so. We still have to choose what to publish, and we still have to know what's good and what's not. And we also need to still help writers find this place where they should be. So that part of it, it's just what books are going to be like. Books, you know, as pieces of thing, what are they going to be? Are they maybe all digital? It's okay. You still have to have people who understand what a good book is.
Implants, chips. We'll just put them in subcutaneous books.
I want one.
I do too.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Shannon Ravenel, co-founder of Algonquin Books. Lee Smith, author of a number of books on Agate Hill and her most recent Guests on Earth. Clyde Edgerton, an author, a number of works. We will mention The Night Trains and The Bible Salesman. And Jill McCorkle, another talented writer, author of Life After Life and Caroline Moon, to name two. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank, for having us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.